Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode today honoring a man who not only served his country during World War II in a trailblazing way, but also served his community, his hometown of Shafter, California, in a fashion that changed countless lives. Before we dive back into Mert Wiedemann's World War II story, here are a few more comments from the Hometown Heroes Facebook page when we first featured Mert's story 5 years ago. Jacob Riley said, "Mert is an amazing man and wealth of knowledge. Even if you couldn't afford your medicine, he would always find a way to make it work." Susie Rose wrote, "Can never forget Mr. Wiedemann, all the things he did for me when I was an exchange student from the Philippines at Shafter High in 1962-63. I just barely got into town, so I went for a walk to meet the people and familiarize myself with the place. I went to his drugstore and was looking around. Then I was looking at some cameras, particularly the movie camera, which was so fascinating to me. Lo and behold, Mr. Wiedemann gave me one as a gift. I couldn't believe it. From then on, he gave me films and developed them too. Later on, he also spliced them together for me and put them in those metal containers. He did all of this out of the goodness of his heart. He is one awesome man who has a special place in my heart." Again, just a sample. There are dozens more comments with similar sentiments on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, but the reality is, none of those folks in Shafter, California would have been blessed by the huge heart of Mert Wiedemann if he hadn't survived dangerous and daring duty in the Navy during World War II. You heard the statement before the break that he was the first Navy weather officer to fly into a typhoon on purpose. This was after nearly 800 sailors died in Typhoon Cobra, also referred to as Halsey's Typhoon. That was December of 1944. The idea behind these weather reconnaissance missions was to avoid another tragedy of that magnitude. But Mert and the rest of the men on these Navy bombers were in a very vulnerable position.
"That was my job, but I felt so sorry for the crew of the planes we flew in into the storms on a PB-4Y2, which is called a privateer, and that's non-aspirated engine, so they could only go at about 18,000 feet. It's taken up from the B-24, where the B-24 had twin tails, and this privateer had a single tail, a little bit faster than B-24. So then we started tracking at the equator. There's tremendous buildups where the water is warmed, the air is slid down from the north to the equator, and then it rises and heads north again. In rising at the equator with the warm water, there's a tremendous energy introduced, and your clouds will go up to 45, 50, 55,000 feet. Tremendous buildups, tremendous rain, just tremendous. You can't imagine the buildups. You head towards them, and they had, out of Eniwetok Atoll, they had search planes that go in a pie shape, so maybe six or eight planes would take off to monitor what the Japanese were doing and looking for submarines and shipping. They always carried bombs. And I would go in. I was attached to Admiral Nimitz's staff. He didn't know me, though, but one of many, many men that were attached to him. We would go different areas every day to try and locate these storms. And once you located it, then you had to fly into it to find out where the center was. And it was just a terrible... You go in at 1,000 feet, raining so hard you can hardly see out the windows. The plane is going up and down. Everybody in the plane gets sick, practically. And then you come in the center where it's quiet as far as the turbulence is concerned, but below you the ocean is just filled with froth and foam and tremendous waves dashing together, and then you have to go back out of it. And then you circle with the wind counterclockwise, and then you come out, and we had weather observations, and at 1,000 feet you're able to look at your altimeter, set it to altimeter to 1,000 feet, and then read it backwards to get the air pressure.
The barometric pressure.
Barometric pressure, yeah.
And I do have a lot of questions here. I didn't want to stop your momentum there because that was a very vivid description of some of the things you did. But I do have a lot of questions about this. And given how dangerous that was, what you were doing there, I think it's important to note something that happened before Halsey's Typhoon, because Halsey's Typhoon was December of 1944. also known as Typhoon Cobra. But there was something that happened in October of 1944 that was pretty significant in your life. You married a girl from Shafter, the pharmacist's daughter?
Yeah, we'd started school together. We'd gone to church together as infants and known her all my life. And I married her just before I left for Mitcham in school. Her father owned a drugstore in Shafter. In 1919, he moved to Shafter, and there were no drugstores. And he was instrumental. They had a terrible flu epidemic in 1919 all across the United States, and he was able to persuade a doctor to come to Shafter, which was a very important thing at the time. And so I was started in engineering at UCLA, and then when I was out on Eniwetok Atoll, he wrote through my wife that if I would come back and go to pharmacy school after the war, he would give me an interest in the drugstore. And so I graduated from pharmacy school then. So
you had to get through the whole war before you could come back and go to pharmacy school. Oh, yeah. And here's my thinking, and I've heard a lot of different takes on this from different veterans. So it's October of 44. America's been in the war already for almost 3 years. You've got brothers serving in the war. You've had friends from your hometown killed in this war. You know it's dangerous. Were you at all concerned that you're going to marry this girl and then not make it home from the war?
That was a concern of everybody. We got married. I got home on Saturday from Notre Dame. Took me 3 days by airplane to get here. You'd stop at these little airports coming across the United States. Somebody got on that airport with higher priority than you, then you got kicked off. So I left Notre Dame on Thursday night, and I didn't get home until Saturday by noon. So it took parts of 3 days. And we got married, and then right away I had orders to go up to Seattle Weather Station, at the Naval Air Station at Sandpoint, which is in Seattle.
And you got to take your new bride with you?
Yes. You can't believe how nice people were to you. And that's one thing I wanted to say about Chicago. I tell you, you couldn't beat that town. They gave every serviceman free rides on the streetcars that didn't cost you anything, or they would pick you up. They were so good about it. And people all over the United States were the same way. Gosh, when we got up to Seattle, all kinds of people helped us, and we were so dumb and knew so little about what we're doing. We just had been married 4 days, and things were really rough, but everybody was in the same boat.
So you come back home, you guys get married, you ship off to Seattle, you're finding your way there, and this is before the typhoon.
Oh, yeah.
You have not gone into this typhoon reconnaissance yet, so maybe you can paint a picture for the before and the after. So you're in Seattle. You're still an aerologist. Your job is to forecast the weather so these pilots know what they're up against.
The flight down to Los Angeles is an easy flight to forecast because planes are coming and going all the time. You knew what the weather was. You know, it's a rare thing to have bad weather. It's easy to get information. You have all these cities and airports that you have information, or if they're going east, you have all that information to give to the pilots. But headed up to Alaska, there is nothing out to the west, absolutely nothing. And the Russians had ships out there, but they would not cooperate. That was when we were furnishing them with all these trucks and airplanes and everything. The Russian pilots would take over the planes from the Americans and then fly them on to Russia. But Russia would not cooperate with the weather at all. We couldn't get any weather information from them at all.
And so how did you give your pilots a picture of it then?
I gave them a picture, but it wasn't very good. The pilots coming down from Alaska, I would interview them, and they would tell me what the winds were and what kind of weather. And then for the pilots going from Seattle up to, say, Juneau, we had to give them a drawing, a picture of what it looked like. So on a sheet of paper about 15 to 18 inches wide, we'd have to draw them a picture diagram. Here's where they're going to run in clouds and the rain and the winds and what have you. In the following 6 hours after you've interviewed and questioned pilots that have just come down from Alaska, the weather changes completely. And it was an absolute impossible thing to forecast. I know I have pilots so mad at me because I told them the winds would be, say, 30 miles an hour, and they ran into 100-mile-an-hour winds. And that was before we knew anything about the jet stream. The jet stream wasn't discovered. It was discovered by Pan American in 1950. But before that, and during the war, of course, there was no knowledge of the jet stream, and it swings down into Alaska and then down along the coast and then inland across the United States. You know, it dropped down, that's 100-mile-an-hour winds or 120-mile-an-hour winds. We knew nothing about that wind. And so when it dropped down lower and the pilots happened to hit that. Well, this one pilot barely made it into land in Alaska, and we had no knowledge. We kept thinking that pilot didn't know what he's talking about. But they sent me up on a trip to Anchorage and out to Dutch Harbor and Kiskanet too, along the chain, and then up to Point Barrow, trying to give me a little background on the area that I was forecasting for. And when I got home from that, finding out all this information about Alaska, I had orders waiting for me to go to Pearl Harbor for training in typhoon reconnaissance. And so there I went. And
well, I want to take you back a little bit. Again, you were talking about trying to forecast this weather, and really, it really is nothing more than an educated guess.
That's right.
And maybe not all that educated.
No, not very educated. Well, you tried to by talking to pilots that have made the trip. But, you know, a front can move in 6 hours, changes the picture completely. You know, the wind directions change. The front comes in, the wind direction changes and picks up. And so it's absolutely a tough proposition.
And did that weigh on you? Was that intimidating to think that these guys' lives are in your hands?
I tell you what, when I get home, we had a telephone then. I get home, I'd wake up during the night to see if the pilot made it. Talk about waiting. I tell you, I was scared to death all the time that I would be a cause of a pilot going down. I did that, I mean, not just once. I did that many times on flights that I was worried about whether they would make it or not.
And you mentioned that one who barely made it to Juneau because the jet stream, which no one knew about, was altering his progress. And he came and had a few words with you?
Oh, yes.
What did he say?
Well, it was a common thing.
Oh, it didn't only happen once? Well, I'm glad you survived.
Because
that.
The weather is terrible flying in those days. You know, high altitude, you had to fly up there at 18,000 or 17,000, whatever it was.
And then you mentioned you actually got to go up there to see some of these areas you're going to be forecasting for. And I understand that on part of that trip, your transportation was not airplane or automobile or train, but dog sled?
Oh, well, that was when I went to Point Barrow, you know, which is the northernmost point of the United States. The Seabees were looking for oil up there. And so the Navy had established an air base up there where they could service the Seabees that were looking for oil. The Navy base was, I think, 4 or 5 miles from the Eskimo village. And the Eskimo village was just a bunch of tin shacks. I mean, they had driftwood and everything made up their shacks, and they were covered with snow. They had one entrance. But at that was a building built by the United States government that was occupied by a government official who was supposed to look over the Eskimos and, you know, whatever they do, just like on Indian reservations, they had a man that's supposed to look over them and protect them. So they called up and had a Eskimo bring out a sled for me to take me into the village. It's kind of a homemade sled, and we went along that trail, and it was bumps, and it was all ice, and it just bumped and turned over, and, you know, no blankets on the sled. I about froze to death, although I had very heavy Arctic clothing on. Anyway, so we got in the village, and I spent the time there with one day with the people, the government couple that oversees the village, just to see what kind of conditions they had, just to look over to see their landing field, to see what it looks like when the fog comes in and how fast it comes in and forms, and you have an ice fog, and you see the terrible conditions that those pilots had to fly in, and gives you respect for what those pilots have to do.
And I wonder, I mean, there's no way of knowing, but I'm just guessing you might have been the first farm boy from Shafter to take a journey on an Inuit dog sled.
That could be. I'm sure that's true.
And then I understand your trip home from up there got a little rocky. The plane that you were on ran into some really cold weather.
Oh, I see. Well, that's when we went from Dutch Harbor. We took off from Dutch Harbor to head up to Attu and Akiska, and there was a front moving in, and we ran into through that front. I was sitting between the pilot and co-pilot, and we had a plane full of drums of gasoline, and we're about 7,500 feet altitude. I was watching the temperature on the gauge sitting there because I knew there was a front there. All of a sudden, ice formed all over the airplane, and it just sounded like a machine gun with the ice flying off the propeller. And I was dumping de-icer fluid in, and when we turned around, we barely made it back to the field. When we got there, the whole plane was covered with ice. It was thick ice on the plane. Wonder if the thing ever flew.
And you had a bunch of people waiting for you on the ground?
Oh,
to see
yeah,
if you
they
made
had
it.
Fire engines and ambulance and everything on.
Did you tell your wife about that one, or did you keep that one to yourself?
Oh, no. After the war, I didn't tell them anything about how scared I was.
Then we come to this point where the typhoon happens in December in the Pacific. Halsey's typhoon, Typhoon Cobra, three destroyers are sunk, nearly 800 men lose their lives. We've talked to survivors of some of those ships on this show over the years, and that was the impetus for this decision. The Navy now is going to have you fly into typhoons to try to get a reading on some of these conditions and hopefully be able to predict the performance, the action, the tendencies of a typhoon in the future. So you had to go out to the Pacific to do this, and you couldn't tell anyone where you were going?
Well, in those days, you weren't supposed to tell anybody. I mean, it's ridiculous, but you weren't supposed to tell anybody where you're going. No matter where you're going, you're not supposed to tell anybody. But
you figured out a way to leave some clues for your wife?
I'd send her out, like, I'd say, Patricia and E. Weedman, and then Patricia N. Weedman, and then Patricia, and spelled out the name of where we're going. So then they looked up on a map of the Pacific and found out where, so they knew the island.
So each letter you'd address with a different middle initial?
Yeah.
So that took a while for her to figure it out.
That's right.
That is funny. That's a neat code you had there.
Yeah.
And how do they prepare you for typhoon reconnaissance? If no one has ever done this before in the history of the world, how do they teach you how to do it?
Well, they didn't. We went to class,
yeah.
But he had no, I mean, they told us that we'd expect turbulence, you know, and the basic things about the wind and everything. But no, the instructor had never flown in a typhoon. And the only people that had flown in typhoons, they got caught. Just to show you how further north, the Navy lost two airplanes. Now, I don't know whether our friends are, and during the war, you couldn't find any out in the information about anything, you know. Mm-hmm. But we heard that two planes went down. That's one thing we're lucky about. They were terrible where we were, but the far worse, you know, winds up to 180 or 150 by the time it hit the Philippines, you know. But nobody realizes that they had no eye in the sky at that time. They had to send a plane into to follow to know where exactly where that typhoon was.
That was the only way to know, to find out. But how did you feel about that idea, especially since nobody's done that before? And it sounds so dangerous to fly into weather that you know is destructive. How did you feel about that idea?
I was scared to death. But I was, you know, you really do. You just,
yeah.
And then you get into it, and you just up and down. But the people I really felt sorry for as a crew, that was my duty. I mean, I didn't request it. But nevertheless, the Navy says, you're there, weatherman, and you've got to fly in there, and we've got to know where the centers are, and you've got to track them. And that's my job in the Navy. The job of those pilots and crews were to bomb ships and bomb islands and watch for, it ran out of gas. So to them, they just hated it. Well, I know the co-pilot, he got the first one in, he just got so sick, he just couldn't even. You know, he was just a young kid, 22 or 23 years old. The captain was 26 years old, Russ Hamilton, but he was one of many that I flew in with, but he was a Christian, and I was very close to that crew. But anyway.
You think they would have rather faced
yes. You can imagine it's almost, they thought it was certain death to go into one of them.
Did you?
I did, too.
So how did you deal with that, especially once you found out that wife of yours was pregnant?
Well, you know, you feel badly about it, but you have an insurance policy for $10,000, and they'll take care of her the rest of her life.
That's what you thought?
That's what it was thought.
Yeah. Did that add a different level of gravity to it when you did find out that she was expecting?
Oh, yes. You know, of course it did. Well, first of all, I wanted to get back and see my child. But, you know, you just can't, I can't tell you how frightening that was for myself and the whole crew. Then I think about those poor guys that go in the beach and get trapped and killed, and what's happened in Tarawa and the rest of those islands. Like Eniwetok, 2 miles long and a half a mile wide, and they have 2,000 casualties, you know, going in and taking that island.
Always aware of the price that was paid and the sacrifices made, Mert Weedman was proud to have contributed in a way that hopefully saved lives. When we come back, more about those weather reconnaissance missions and the men who flew them, and a few more thoughts on Mert Weedman's legacy. Shafter, California, lost a real hometown hero this week at the age of 97. We'll be right back after this.